Officially begin our session. So, Michelle, I can see that you are on camera and you are off mute. So, I'm going to turn the video spotlight over to you and let you begin today's session.
Great. Thank you so much, Jean, for hosting us today and helping us with our webinar. As everyone knows, and I hope some of you are repeats, this is an ongoing webinar series that we do about mining site cleanup. And I want to make sure that everyone is aware that on Kluin, we also have this website for issues related to cleanup at mining sites where you can find lots of new information that we post. We also archive all of these webinars, so you'll be able to find those on this website also. Next slide, Jean. And as we mentioned, this is part of a series. Here is the direct link if you want to see all of the archive webinars, and the one that you're watching now will be posted when it's available. And, you know, we do these about quarterly, so, you know, stay tuned and we'll have more mining webinars. And if you ever have any ideas for topics, please reach out to me. Next slide. And then today we are very excited to have Lee Daniels from Virginia Tech to talk to us about assessment and rehabilitation of humid region mine site and waste. Next slide. And so Lee Daniels, as I mentioned, is a professor at Virginia Tech, and we're very excited to have him with us. So we in the Superfund program have worked with Lee on cleaning up mining sites for many, many years. So we're so excited to have him back with his presentation, and I think you'll find it very enjoyable. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Daniels.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. Let me get to the right point here, and hopefully everyone is seeing on my screen.
Everything looks great.
Again, I am Lee Daniels with Virginia Tech. In the School of Plant and Environmental Sciences. My contact information is here. And I just want to point out that we do have a pretty extensive outreach and research website. And I will more than likely go through a lot of stuff conceptually today rather quickly. And in addition to the posted slides, there are all the citations and references and other studies I talk about are available from this website. So my objectives today are to talk really in general about what is my personal view and that of many of my colleagues about the major factors affecting overall reclamation and revegetation success in the humid region. I want to talk a lot about mine soil, mine land reconstruction protocols. I'm not going to talk a lot about revegetation per se, but I will talk about different ways we go through considering mining waste and overburden and other materials to sort of custom fit them to the intended post-mining land use and particularly a revegetation system. Again, I'm not going to talk a lot about revegetation. I will talk a little bit about reforestation with natives because that's an important aspect of what we do. After a short break in the middle, I am going to talk in quite a bit of detail about acid-base accounting methods because they're critical to any analysis we do, as far as I'm concerned. In most areas of the world anyway, is a first step in making sure of what we're dealing with. I'm also going to talk, I hope, at the end a little bit about work we've done on predicting TDS, or the emission of total dissolved solids from Appalachian coal mining environments. If I don't get through that material completely at the end, I will at least wade into a little bit. And again, there's extensive references and a range of current journal articles on that posted to our website. So again, I'm going to be talking mainly about two different mining environments that I and a number of my colleagues have worked with extensively. One of them is Appalachian coal mining, and the other one is mineral sands mining in the eastern coastal plain. That's also applicable widely to sites ranging from Florida and also to a certain extent to tens of thousands of acres of sand and gravel mining operations in the the coastal plain. But first, let's talk about coal mining environments. Historically, of course, we were really focused on, particularly with the passage of the Surface Mining Act in 1977 and thereafter, on managing against acid mine drainage. And so a lot of what we learned over the last 30, 40 years has been focused upon how we go into a mining site like this, particularly in a pre-mining environment, and what sets of analyses we need to do, what we need to do to predict then the suitability of these varying materials. Because you can see just in this one picture, there's a huge contrast of pre-weathered brown oxidized materials here, unweathered hard rock, gray spoils, and then what are most likely acid-forming materials, which is down here on a mined-out coal bench. And so really the focus of what I started on working on actually back in 1982 has been what parameters do we need to make sure we assess, particularly whenever possible in a pre-mining environment, so we know which materials we want to save and which ones we want to isolate, and then how do we pick and choose among these materials? For example, if I know I want to go back to hayland and pasture versus possibly going back to reforestation with native hardwoods, which are obviously the dominant local vegetation here. Now, in conjunction with that over time, that there's been a tremendous change in scale, particularly since the 1970s in the scale of mining. And so now we deal and then have been dealing historically until the recent downturn in the coal market with much larger mines than the one I just showed you in the background. This is where, particularly in the southern and central Appalachians, these issues with TDS discharge, particularly moderately saline waters with SCs and often over 1,000 microsiemens per centimeter being emitted, particularly from these large valley fills that often have a couple million yards of overburden spoil in them, and the aquatic impacts. And again, I'm going to address that end of this towards the end of my talk here. But again, I'm not positive how far I will get through it. But it is important to note that in our coal mining environment, particularly in the last 20 years, there's been a greater emphasis on the reclamation, restoration of the native forest lands. Most of the work that I'm talking about has occurred here in the border of Southwest Virginia up against Eastern Kentucky and Southern West Virginia. But again, we have a tremendous diverse native forest there. And there's been a huge shift in emphasis in terms of analyzing and evaluating coal mining materials with respect to what do we do to hopefully manage them in a soil reconstruction framework and get back into some sort of native forest revegetation. And I do want to note a lot of these materials are co-authored, or the primary author has been my colleague, Carl Zipper. Now, important point, and I think this is true of most mining environments I've ever worked in, we tend to focus on the mining site itself, the mine pit, the disturbance area, the overburden involved. But in coal mining and in metal mining and an awful lot of other areas I've worked with, the fact of the matter is revegetating and reclaiming the mining site itself is often much easier than dealing with the processing waste. And for example, there's thousands of acres of coal waste piles, refuse piles, gob piles, or slate dumps, whichever term is used locally, where particularly with deep mining and with the emphasis on lowered ash content and sulfur content in marketed coal since the 1970s and 80s, there are just tremendous volumes of what are quite often, and particularly with respect to coal refuse, acid-forming materials that, again, are being placed into large valley fills often or large above-grade fills that also have significant long-term issues in terms of both revegetation, in terms of can we even direct seed these materials, or do they have to be topsoiled and covered, and then water quality discharge issues. And again, there are literally many of the piles that I've worked with in Southwest Virginia alone are several hundred acres in size. They can be 100 to 200 feet deep. And 9 out of 10 of them, at least I've worked with in the region, are definitely net acid for materials. Excuse me. And a lot of them, because of their permitting, sufficient native topsoil either was not saved and salvaged for their completion, or to get some sort of a topsoil substitute on them, you necessarily have to go into unmined land adjacent to them and actually do more disturbance just to get cover materials for them. So again, I'm not going to focus on a lot of mining waste per se, but a few of my examples will definitely pertain to coal waste. Now, let's change gears, and I'll be talking about another very different mining environment, and this is mineral sands mining that has occurred at these two locations today in Virginia. Here's the city of Richmond. Of course, Washington, D.C. is about two and a half miles north. This is the location. There's been two major bodies of mineral sands, and these are mainly Zilmanite and Zircon mined in Virginia today. There's been thousands of acres of mineral sands mined in Central Florida, some in Georgia, and historic mining at other locations in the East. This is large area mining. I think it was not understood by a lot of folks the scale of this to date. This is the old Hickory mine. The mining company here is Iluka Resources, who I've had a great relationship with since 1990. But again, they're basically mining a coastal plain capping that overlies the Piedmont with a depth between 30 and 40 feet, with significant enrichment of the mineral sands in the soil profile, and then going through a sort of a checkerboard game in back of them, backfilling all the mined out pits as they proceed through the landscape. Now, this is a completely different environment from the Appalachian coal mining. This is prime farmland. In fact, this field that's right in the middle of the deposit has been unmined today. This was the state champion peanut producing field in Virginia two times in the 1980s. There is potential, if we include deposits and similar deposits in North Carolina, which have not been mined but are still under lease, there's potential for thousands more acres of this to be mined. And that dark color you see in that soil there, that's not topsoil, that is ilmenite. And if you were to look at it in close-up, this is a tremendously rich, was probably the most important mining area in North America for these minerals in the past 30 years. So it's a very rich deposit. The white material there is zircon. The black material there is ilmenite, and the sort of ruby sort of color you can see there is rutile. This is the native soil. This is that prime farmland soil I talked about. Beautiful soil. Yes, it's an acid soil. Yes, it has a lot of clay in its subsoil that then poses certain issues in terms of reclamation, because it generates a lot of silt plus clay, which collectively is known by the industry as slimes. But again, because this is so rich, again, it has driven the overall mining efforts. And an interesting fact of the matter is there's actually greater heavy mineral accumulation in the upper topsoil layers than at depth, because of a combination of a long-term sheet erosion and wind erosion of the much lower density quartz versus the much higher density heavy minerals, which often have a particle density above 4.5. So how this material is mined is the topsoil is moved aside and saved in a berm, and that's what you see here, although the berms are usually off the edge of the mining pit. But basically, they run everything through a water separation cyclone and spiraling process, and it goes back in pits. So here, what's left behind is 60% quartz, what they call tailings, but 40% basically iron-coated kaolinite, and that's what the industry calls them slimes, and I'll be talking about that term later on. Now, sand and gravel mining in certain instances also generates substantial slimes, depending on how much finer textured material gets processed at a sand and gravel mining operation. So those are two contrasting mining environments I'll be using as my primary examples later on in terms of soil reconstruction protocols and how they have varied. But before that, I want to go through sort of a checklist of, regardless of what site I think you look at anywhere in the world, frankly, what are going to be the four most common things that are going to control your success and the ability for you to use a given rock strata or a material in soil reconstruction, and what else will be driving you, particularly number one here in terms of the water quality. And the first thing is, there's no doubt that if significant sulfidic materials or pyrites are in the mining column or are going to be left at or near anywhere the surface and not isolated, that it's the number one thing you need to assess first. Now, that doesn't mean they occur everywhere. In fact, many of our Appalachian coal mines are very low in pyrite. I'm not saying that all mines have sulfide problems, but if they are present, they are the dominant first thing that must be assessed up front. And of course, we've had a large history of them in the Appalachian coal mining belt and other areas and metal mining areas and worldwide issues. We're fortunate in Southwest Virginia, for example, of 30 or so mineable seams of coal, we only have three or four that, like this one, which was known as the Standiford seam, had a significant acid forming problem. But this overburden, for example, had been sitting out here for about 20 years when I took this picture, and still nothing was, it's invading on it. We'll talk more about pyrite oxidation and how we predict these effects later on. I don't want to get us hung up on this, but the basic chemistry is pyrite occurs in many geologic materials and environments. When we bring it up to the surface, expose it to oxygen and water with time, the thermodynamics, and at some point in time, the kinetics of how quickly the reaction occurs, particularly once the pH gets down under about 4.5, just take over. And so we generate very large amounts of acidity. So we commonly start with mining waste or overburden with pH 7 that can go within months to years to a pH 3 and 3.5. And that's an obvious problem. And that, of course, has led to extensive issues, not just with surface mining, but with deep mine discharges, particularly from what they call the hinge line in central West Virginia northward. It's a dominant problem. Again, we do have it further south, but we're fortunate in Southwest Virginia that it is not as much of a dominant issue. It is, I would say, at least in the Appalachians, 8 to 9 out of every 10 coal refuse piles has got significant acid generating potential. And again, one of the major reasons for that is a major objective of the coal cleaning process is to get sulfur out of marketed coal. So it's going to end up in a coal waste pile. And here's all the reaction products we see. We see sulfate salts, we see pH 3 water, iron oxyhydroxide, and what you don't see there is manganese, aluminum, and other potential toxicants. So I'm going to talk in more detail about acid-base accounting and other predictive methods after we take a little Q&A break towards the middle. But again, to avoid this dominant problem up front, any potential mining waste material and its geologic setting needs to be assessed and tested for the potential for acid formation. And again, we'll come back to this chemistry again. If I take pyrite and oxidize it completely with those multiple reactions I just showed you, which, by the way, was a simplified version of the complete pyroxidation reactions, then I end up to neutralizing it either with naturally occurring carbonates in situ or by adding lime to it. The reaction products of complete neutralization are going to be carbon dioxide, and this is a theoretical version here, plus sulfate and calcium in solution. Now, some of that may precipitate in various phases as acid salts and gypsum. Important math here, and we'll talk more about this later on, for every 1% pyritic sulfur we have in a given mine waste or a given product, to fully neutralize it over time, one prediction, and this is the most common method, is that you're going to need around 31 tons of lime per acre, 6 inches deep of spoil, dwarf soil. And we routinely, in many mine environments, see 1% or more pyritic sulfur in these materials. And that's why this is such a dominating issue. We need to make sure we assess up front. However, like I've said a couple times now, in Southwest Virginia and much of Southern West Virginia and parts of Eastern Kentucky, the sulfides tend to be isolated either in the coal measures, the underclay, or in relatively thin seams, but we still have other limitations we need to assess. Without question, my opinion is, and that of many others, is while pyrite and sulfide oxidation is a dominant problem you must assess and make sure you avoid, the most common problem limiting reclamation success, and I've seen it in a wide range of environments, is compaction. Usually related to rubber-tired vehicles, occasionally bulldozers, but typically excessive traffic during mine operations and closure. This is perfectly good spoil up here, pH 6.5 material, moderate fertility, obviously fairly well vegetated at this setting, but there's absolutely no roots in this lower material, even though it's only down there about a foot deep. And so compaction tends to be an overriding problem that's got to be mitigated and dealt with during the active mining and mine spoil placement process. So we'll talk about how we avoid compaction shortly. The next major limiting problem tends to be very coarse textures or very high rock contents that even if the material is not sulfidic and even if it's not highly compacted, directly limit water holding and lead to a droughtiness. There's ways of offsetting that through topsoiling and mine soil amendments I'll be talking about, or just by ensuring you have enough raw depth. But as we cascade down through how we evaluate the materials, then texture or rockiness are things that affect just bulk rooting depth and water holding content, other than compaction is sort of next in our cascade of things we worry about. And here's an extreme example. This is actually a mixture of what got pushed downhill by a bulldozer of everything that at this site was cuttable above hard rock. This is the worst case environment on this site, came out of a sandstone, a very hard sandstone material there that's obviously very coarse. It still has 15% fines in it, which would be soil-sized material. But even in addition to a lot of other wonderful things about this material here, in terms of organic matter content and its ability in terms of supporting forestry, just based on raw water holding ability alone, that there's obviously extreme differences between these two materials. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about topsoil today, but I just want to say that in general, whenever it's economically or logistically or safety feasible, native topsoils, and native topsoil to me is the A plus the E horizon, and any litter layer you can save with it should be saved. In general, there are going to be higher in organic matter, available nitrogen, NP, and most importantly, depending on how they're saved and salvaged over time, beneficial microbial populations, and quite possibly a seed bank as well, depending on how long they're stored and what your revegetation endpoint is. Now, once you've cascaded down through sulfitic materials, compaction, and raw water holding issues, then the next major management thing that I think is most important is how steep is the slope and which way is it facing? In general, we commonly see slopes, particularly on coal waste piles and certain backfills in excess of 35%, particularly when they're south-facing, particularly when they're black and dark in color. Just the heat effects and the albedo effects themselves can really make plant establishment very difficult. You couple that with just the logistics, the difficulties involved in getting amendments and materials up onto steep slopes. That's what then factors in. Now, many times we've got to put the stuff up steep. Return to contour mining, valley fill faces. Certainly, we're going to end up with a lot of steep backfills and fill faces, but it is something you've got to build into management and consideration then of what you're going to do with your final reclamation protocol. Now, things I'm not going to talk about today, but I've dealt with, but usually don't cause us major problems in the humid region, and that's what I'm focusing on. We don't have a lot of mine spoil salinity problems as long as we avoid the sulfitic materials. Now, sulfitic materials generate a load of sulfate salt and will definitely drive salinity up and can be in themselves highly limiting. But as long as we take care of point one, I said, and avoid pyritic materials, usually the salinity issues we see are in discharge waters, in seepage waters, but not in terms of revegetation. Now, there are examples, though, that I'm sure some of you online have dealt with. And particularly in Western mining, we've got to deal with some sodium issues in sodic soils. Again, as long as we avoid sulfitic materials, we seldom have an issue with toxic metals and oxyanions in surface revegetation protocols. Now, there's some exceptions, but there are issues with those, or can be issues with those, though, depending on what they are, in both acid mine drainage discharge and even high pH, high TDS discharge at certain sites, depending on which ion we're talking about. Now, from my perspective, once you take care of the four things I just covered and you evaluate each dominant strata that's going to be available to you, then you start thinking about mine soil amendments, both organic amendments and other appropriate materials, waistlines, alkaline fly ash in its day, although it's not commonly used anymore, and things like fertilizers and agricultural limestone. This is one of the earlier pieces of work we did in the mid-90s, looking at returning a foot of topsoil on these mineral sands lines to alternatives. Now, all this would have been incorporated, but we were able to show readily on this site anyway, that with a combination of yard waste compost, heavy phosphorus fertilization, and liming, and that these are in metric units. If you cut this in two, that's about tons per acre. Kilos per hectare is about the same as pounds per acre. We could just about equal native topsoil in terms of row crop productivity on lands like this. And I'll talk more about another example of this a little later. Topsoil management, but again, saving topsoil, if you can save it, if it's feasible, it's often required by a permit, is a BMP. It's a best management practice. Beyond that, where you can do what is known as direct hauling, meaning you time your topsoil stripping to correspond when you're going to haul it directly the same day or as quickly as possible to a reclamation area and put it down, that is always preferable. And I'll talk more about why that is shortly. If direct haul is not feasible, the topsoil needs to be stored properly in low, meaning not too deep, vegetated, well-drained berms away from active mining pits. Well-drained berms is important because if the middle of the stockpile goes anaerobic, particularly, it changes its suitability drastically. Even if you keep it well-drained, the viability within 3 to 6 months anyway of that inner core of most topsoil berms drops fairly quickly. However, the reason I got into all this stuff back in 1982 was in our coal mining environment, the native topsoils are often quite thin. It's a safety issue. This guy was doing this back in the early 1980s. I don't think you would see this on an active mining site anymore, but it's just hard to strip and save topsoil in certain mining environments, particularly steep slope coal mining environments. So we, with support from the Office of Surface Mining and a number of entities like the Powell River Project, started working in 1980. And I took this picture in 1982 of one of our topsoil placement experiments, just looking at these different rock types in various mixtures in terms of serving as a topsoil substitute. And I want to talk about then how, if this is the objective, if true topsoil is not available to you, but you also need an adequate rooting depth, what the protocols you would go through in terms of reconstructing a viable mine soil for varying land uses out of these topsoil substitutes. So again, sort of cascading down through it, we threw a pre-mine analysis, usually from drill cores, and hopefully several of them that someone has vouched are going to be the dominant material. First, we've got to run the DACID base accounting on it. We almost always want the potential acidity to be less than 5 tons of calcium carbonate lime demand per acre 6 inches. We, in most instances, want the post-placement pH to be over 5 and soluble salts less than 4 millimoles per centimeter. We usually can meet this goal with almost, in our region and many overburdened materials, as long as we can meet this the potential acidity criteria. And even if the pH is less than 5, as long as it doesn't have a high level of potential acidity, we can add relatively routine liming amounts to it and get that pH up into the 5 to 6 or even higher range. For these coarser materials, we find that you need a minimum of 20% soil-sized materials. And we've actually seen, even with spoils that have 60, 70% rock in them, as long as you can get it out there uncompacted and thick enough, meaning in our systems, usually 3 to 4 feet thick, that is uncompacted, we can see relatively good, and in fact, often outstanding plant growth of both forages and native tree species, as long as we get it out there thick enough. But you've got to work with the overall mine plan, as I'll be talking about here shortly, to make sure you get it out there thick enough so there's at least a half a meter, or say 2 feet, and preferably 3 to 4 feet of that suitable material. I'm going to contrast this more later. We find, at least in evaluating hard rock overburden, I've seen this in a lot of mining types. It doesn't matter if it's granite mining or coal mining, conventional soil testing, the conventional test you get back from a soil testing lab with Malik 1 or Malik 3 or Blay, whatever, is of really limited value, particularly for evaluating extractable nutrients, because those tests were simply never calibrated for these materials. Now, in certain instances, we will like and will actually prefer a slightly more acidic topsoil substitute down to, say, pH 4.5. But frankly, even most of our native forest species do better between 5 and 5.5 than down at 4.5. So again, this is a good example of what I was saying. This is a pre-weathered, oxidized material. This is a high pH material that's not going to be suitable in terms of native forest species. This is a mixture of these pre-weathered materials higher in fines. It actually has a pH of about 5.5. Okay, now can we use the same soil analysis and approach in terms of these tailings and slimes? This is obviously a different environment. They're going to take the whole mining column here, save topsoil, and homogenize everything downward. But because this is dominantly pre-weathered material, it turns out that we can use conventional soil testing analyses, at least nutrient testing, to probably accurately reflect what's in these materials. So for the two materials I just showed you, the high pH sandstone spoil and those mineral sands minings, tailings and slimes, with the same test, this would be Malik 1 soil extract. These are actually reasonable numbers. These tell us, yes, this stuff is dead low in calcium, it's pH 5, and it's got no phosphorus in it. And that's exactly what's in it. These sandstone spoils, though, particularly sandstone and siltstone spoils in the Appalachians and ground rock, granites, feldspars, and other rocks that have not been pre-weathered have a very bad habit of throwing very high numbers for things like calcium, magnesium, and phosphorus, that if you believe as a reclamation practitioner, those are plant available nutrients, you're kidding yourself. And if you skip fertilization applications based on these soil tests, you're going to end up in trouble. Issues with overburden placement, and this is specific largely to coal mining and probably hard rock mining. Some of this is applicable to sand and gravel mining. You've got to work with your mining engineers. You've got to work with your consultants. You've got to understand what they're willing to do and capable to doing economically or logistically, but there's also the whole regulatory and the permitting end of it, of what they're required to. You've got to have a mining plan that will get adequate material for full soil profile reconstruction and be able to manipulate it and move it at the right times, or store it and get it out at that site. In doing so, you need to remember that the mining industry, particularly mining engineers doing the cut and fill and the basics costs never want to handle anything twice. Therefore, ideally, you want to isolate both the subsoil and the topsoiling material you want and work with the mining plan to get it isolated, hauled, and placed in one motion. Topsoil isolation and reuse in most circumstances, unless you get a company that is really into direct haul or that is required by permit, which it is in some countries in certain locations in this country. But unless they're doing direct haul, it's going to be double handled. And that means it's going to be picked up once or sometimes triple handled, put in a storage area, brought back out to a final reclaim area, and then handled again in some way in terms of bulldozing or final placement. So here's an example of a common problem we've had in the Appalachians for years, particularly in the last 20 years. This brown pre-weathered material, particularly this upper portion, is actually the material I showed you in the earlier photo of that nice combination of everything you could push with a bulldozer. This material at depth is pH 7.5 to 8 because it's high carbonates. The pure economics of surface mining would indicate that after this material is shot out of this pit and the coal is extracted down here, which is down here about 10 more feet, the pure economics of mining would say the cheapest thing to do is you push this material into the pit, but to get to the coal, you obviously have to haul this stuff out. So just through that economic push for decades and decades, we ended up getting an awful lot of the better material in terms of native reforestation buried in pits, and the higher pH, high carbonate, and often somewhat finer textured materials hauled out and ending up on the final reclamation surfaces. Now, if the objective is hayland and pasture, this stuff is great, assuming you can take care of fertilizer needs, which is typically only nitrogen and phosphorus. However, if the objective is native reforestation, this material is highly problematic because our native species don't tolerate pH 7.5 to 8. So this is what I just covered. These are complications. These are things that as you work with the mine planners or the active on-site folks in terms of trying to work out the checkerboard there is, or the chess match, if you wish, of materials handling, getting onto those final reclaimed surfaces are things you just have to keep in mind. Asking them to blend two different strata that don't occur together can be highly problematic, and you may just get a simple no on that. Say, no, I can't do that. If they don't occur in the same shot or the same mining lift that are going to be hauled at the same time, getting them blended is going to be tough. Again, I've emphasized enough how important planning is and timing of this, and wherever possible, the final lift of material that's going to be the upper 3 to 4 feet of that final surface needs to be hauled to that final surface, needs to be end dumped in closely spaced piles whenever possible, and then bladed off and left as rough as possible as is consistent with the post-mining land use. Because not only for simple compaction revegetation issues, the rougher we leave it, usually the better infiltration we get, and it minimizes runoff. And lots of folks have shown tremendous increases in simple revegetation success for both herbaceous species and forest species for areas that are left rough graded rather than smooth graded and quote unquote tracked in. If I hate to see anything on a mining site or a highway cut, I hate to see sites that get tracked in. I think my personal opinion is that's a negative practice. However, to be consistent with certain post-mining land uses, like cutting hay, you obviously need to get a decent grade on a surface and those larger rocks out of the way. I'm not going to talk a lot about revegetation here, as I promised. Here's just some, you know, common practices we can see here. We can see here a final bulldozing on a steep backfill. This is the better, browner material. This is the final end dumping occurring at the top of that backfill. And then, hydroseeding, of course, is our most common method. In coal mining, depending on the landowner objectives and the permitting, since the 1980s anyway, we've seen some contrasting land uses. Many areas, particularly where they're gently sloping, are in hayland and pasture, particularly if the landowner agrees to and the permitting is set up such there is proof and evidence that they will end up in that land use. Historically, a lot of areas went into what was called wildlife habitat stabilization covers. That's what this area was here, and this area here. I won't go into it in detail, but a lot of what you see in here are species that weren't planted there. A lot it is autumn olive that at the time of this acceding wasn't being planted or was planted and it ends up being invasive and other species coming in. The zone through the middle here is an example of the pre-existing native forest land in this location. This particular location is at the Powell River Project area in Wise County, Virginia, where an awful lot of our research has been done. And then you can see active mining up here in the background. So one thing I do want to talk about just as an example of this is something called the forestry reclamation approach. These folks whose names you can barely see, Jim Berger, Don Graves, Pat Angel, Vic Davis, and Carl Zipper, along with Jeff Skousen from West Virginia and Chris Barton and several others from UK, basically, I could say, invented this approach starting in the late 1990s, particularly with leadership from the U.S. Office of Surface Mining about how do we reconstruct these mine soils, particularly for native reforestation, because that became a major regulatory and a major objective of particularly the unregulated community in the region. Let me leave it that way. So there's five steps. One is you need 4 feet of the best available material. It needs to be the brown pre-weathered material. You need to end dump it and loosely grade it. You need to avoid compaction. You need to use ground covers that are compatible, meaning you don't want to use tall fescue and Sericea lespediza. And just as important, you want to cut back on the fertilizer rates. You don't want to put a full nitrogen rate down. You want to put down just enough to get the herbaceous vegetation to meet minimum sediment and erosion control standards, but not compete against your trees. You want to have a mix of species planted out there and use proper tree planting techniques. Now, I'm going to focus a little bit here and just show some examples of the first three steps here. This is an area that was end dumped, or in this example, is being reworked with this track loader. Now, for reforestation, some areas are actually left this rough. In most instances, this would be regraded out, and this would still qualify as something approaching rough grading. Then we often final rip. We know that regardless of the processes we do in end dumping and final bulldozing, that there will still be a compaction. So particularly that these areas that are being going back into native reforestation should be ripped. This is an example here of the mixture of species planted. This is about a 7-year-old stand. You can also see all kinds of other stuff invading in, which is always a good sign. So again, that's just one example of how we've integrated these concepts of choosing the right spoil, selecting it, getting it out on a site, and then integrated it into a revegetation protocol. Now, and here's my friend Jim Berger in front of an older stand. Yeah, there's some stuff there that I don't think Jim intended out there. But again, we've seen very good success with the FRA as long as we can follow those steps. And there's no question the two most critical steps are getting the right pre-weathered brown spoil out there whenever possible and minimizing compaction. You take care of those two problems and get decent planting stock out there, usually things work well. If you get that gray, high pH siltstone and sandstone out there, I don't care what you throw out it, a lot of times the trees are not going to do well. And that's just the reality of their adaptation. Coal waste presents its own set of problems. Talked a little bit, they're almost all acid forming. We generate a lot of coal waste at this particular site. The company was interested in direct seeding, meaning not bringing in a topsoil cover. This particular material needed 45 tons per hectare or about 20 tons per acre of lime on it. This was a gentle enough slope that they could work it in. They were moderately successful at this site. Parts of it met their 5-year bond, parts did not. However, once you get the lime demand above anything between 15 to 20 tons of lime per acre, 6 inches deep, you're going to see limited success, particularly on south-facing hot slopes, without a minimum of a foot or two of some kind of a topsoil or topsoil substitute cover, coupled with a lime blanket at the contact. And we have a lot of materials posted on our website about that approach. We have done, though, a lot of work with organic amendments. I'm a major believer in the use of organic amendments, particularly at appropriate loading rates, 20, 30, 40 dry tons per acre, coupled with lime on acid forming or black salty materials like you see here. This particular material was a paper mill sludge. This is another example of direct seeding on a coal waste pile. Again, the amendments here were lime at about 12 tons per acre and biosolids at 35 dry tons per acre and an acid salt to tolerant seed mix. We see similar results with yard waste compost, composted manures, biosolids. I've worked a lot with biosolids over time because they were for a number of years readily available to us, but we have similar results. And I'm an advocate of using, particularly for direct seeding, where topsoiling is not feasible, using relatively high rates of organic amendments. All right. Let me finish up before our little break here and talk about the other mining environment. Again, this is highly productive farmland. Here, the expectation of these landowners when all this started back in the early 1990s and assertions of several mining companies involved was that they intended to get these lands back to these landowners after mining to at least put back into row cropping systems and, if possible, approach prime farmland status. And that was a goal that was put in front of us. So again, the issue here is what you're dealing with is pH 5, essentially zero phosphorus materials. They tend to segregate into sands on one end of the pit and slimes on the other end of the pit. To get some homogenization and some final grade on these, there was quite a bit of emphasis early on obviously this is in the early 2000s, about getting up on these pits and working these materials out and getting them graded out as quickly as possible. That led to heavy compaction. If you let the water free drain out of a soil and have it at what a soil scientist would call field capacity or just drier, that ends up being at the ideal moisture content to just compact the hell out of this stuff. So this is what we saw commonly, in addition to some other issues here, like the topsoil being buried here instead of up top. But here we see a heavily compacted mined soil material, basically banded tailings and slimes laid out in layers with a bulk density approaching 1.6 to 1.7. Now at this location, it was a little lower portion in the landscape and surface water was coming to it. And that's the only reason it was well vegetated. There's no roots here any deeper than 6 inches in this soil. So the answer was working with the company again in the 2000s. Once we went through an assessment and said, your problem with even getting anywhere near row cropping potential here is it's too compacted. So a couple of innovative engineers, and here's one of them, Clint Zimmerman, who's now working with Luckstone, said, well, we'll just rip it. We can actually do this at scale. We use these rippers for tearing out roads and tearing up berms. We'll just use them. And so this was implemented. Here's an example of the practice. They rip one way and then rip again. They then bring out the topsoil that's been stored. Now, this then generates more compaction, all right, because of the use of the pans. So to some extent, you sometimes undo the good you've done. They do blade the topsoil out with a bulldozer, and then in some instances, we'll actually deep rip through the whole system again, but usually we'll pull a really heavy chisel plow through that topsoil layer and get the chisel plow teeth down at least a few inches, because the topsoil is only going to be about 6 inches deep. You can pull a chisel plow a foot to 18 inches in these materials and then re-loosen that contact. And that's what we think is the best management practice. Now, in addition to that, note that they have restored contour. And I'm not going to talk about geomorphic or topographic reconstruction today, but it's very important to get a little bit of a surface convexity and to get water and some sort of drainage back off these surfaces and not leave them too flat. Okay, so in this environment, then we put in a 10-year study. This is the first year yields relative to certain treatments. One is conventional topsoiling. Now, these areas were all deep ripped, but they were not subsequently chisel plowed like I just talked about. Right on the mixtures of tailings and slimes, we used biosolids, and these are pretty reasonable corn yields. Most farmers in Virginia would be quite happy with 174 bushels per acre. We were able to out-yield fertilizer with the organic amendment. Now, how did we do relative to a prime farmland? Well, unmined adjacent prime farmland was 220, and these days with improved management, we often see yields in excess of 300 bushels per acre now on some of these unmined fields. However, the county average for all row crop lands in row crops in the county was 98. So depending on what you've got set as a yield target, we can say that with this and other work we've done, with this mix of soil reconstruction protocols, we can usually get back within a few years, 75, 80% of the pre-mining yield. And then with time, we think we might get up into the 85, 90%, but we will probably, and I don't think ever, be able to completely get something back to its original high prime farmland status, at least in this environment, but we can certainly get it up to a fairly reasonable level of yield. Now, what happened with the topsoil? The topsoil did not get chisel plowed when this experiment went in. We hadn't come up with that practice at the time. So it was compacted and it did crust. It was remediated with a chisel plowing in 2005. And then in subsequent years after that, we saw similar yields with time, regardless of what the crop was coming out of topsoil or the tailings and biosolids or the fertilizer treatments. And we were consistently able to beat a county average, but often not here. All right, so we still work with this company. A lot of it is coming back into forages, but there is a limited amount of it that is coming back into row cropping. So summary, I've got a couple slides here and we will take a 10 minute break and come back. The vast majority of mining waste and overburden of materials we can successfully reclaim and revegetate, assuming we do that sort of hierarchy of analyses. But again, assuming that absolutely we need to avoid sulfidic materials, we need to isolate them. And if not, it's going to take very high rates of liming and probably some sort of a thick soil or a topsoil cover. Assuming you avoid sulfidics, it's going to be compaction, rockiness texture, slope and aspect. That's what is challenging. I think simple management of pH and fertility is the easiest part of what we do. The hardest part of what we do is soil reconstruction, identifying the best materials and working with the mining operator or the contractor who is cleaning up a site in terms of working them through those processes and those soil reconstruction protocols. A priori testing up front of all proposed revegetation strata has got to be done. And again, once you're beyond these things, rock type, how pre-weathered it is, what its water holding content are also very important to predict as part of that analytical process. Again, I almost ignore conventional soil tests when I look at fertility parameters in anything other than a highly pre-weathered soil. I don't think you can reliably use them for predicting calcium, magnesium, potassium, and phosphorus availability in any hard rock overburden soil. I'm an advocate of organic amendments. I've talked about that. And again, I think we get overly worried about soil fertility and compaction though is gonna need to be ripped or avoided during a placement. I can't tell you how many marketing ploys I've seen for gypsum and that you can put gypsum down and it's gonna work voodoo magic and the spoil is gonna be loosened to a depth of 2 feet. In our environment, that doesn't happen. If you have deep-seated compaction, you're going to have to rip it out, and magic potions aren't going to work. My final comment then before we take a combination of a Q&A and a break is on any active mining site or any site you say as a practitioner have got to go up in a post-mining environment, never tell a local stakeholder or landowner that your soil and land are going to look just the same after mining and will be just productive as it is today. It may be for certain crops, perhaps hayland and pasture, you may be able to meet that goal. But for row cropping and often reforestation, it's not going to look the same. It's not going to be the same. And particularly for row cropping and intensive uses, when you make that sort of a promise, it will likely come back and bite you if you're not careful about it. Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn it back to Michelle, and we'll go from there in terms of Michelle and Jean and how they want to handle things from here.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Daniels. I think, yeah, we were going to take a 10-minute break. Jean, I think we were going to maybe take 5 minutes where people could step away, and then after the 5 minutes, we could start asking some questions as we
finish
the break.
That is exactly correct, Michelle. So what we'll do is I'm going to start the timer for our break. And so for those who need to step away, go right ahead. So for this first 5 minutes, we will just pause and let anyone who needs to step away go right ahead. But those who wish to stay at their device, feel free to continue entering in your questions and comments into the Q&A space. Remember, those are private messages. And then after this 5 minute break period, we'll start queuing through some of those questions and take some time to respond to those. And if you have no questions, you can also put that into the Q&A window. That also helps us ensure that we're using our time appropriately. So again, enjoy your brief break, and we will be here silently in the background, scrolling through those questions and getting ready to resume with the session. Okay, Michelle. So as we are coming to the end of the first part of our break time. Ah, that's our quick audio reminder that break time is over. I'll just let everybody know that the technical presentation will carry on here in just a few moments, but there's still time to enter in additional questions and comments into the question queue. Dr. Daniels, it might be helpful if you want to call your screen back up just in case some of the questions relate back to your presentation materials. And as he's doing that, Michelle, I'll turn it over to you to start sifting through some of the questions and comments we've received to see if we can read through some of those in our few moments remaining for our break time.
Have you got my screen up now?
I do. Everything looks great.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so I've seen a number of questions have come in. So thank you, everyone, for submitting your questions while we took that break. And please continue to submit them as we're doing our Q&A here and as we go through the remainder of Dr. Daniels' presentation. So if you're ready, Lee, I'm going to read through some of these questions for you. So we had someone ask, they want to know if the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act requires removing and stockpiling topsoil removed from the site prior to the mining operation?
Yes and no. If the native topsoil or the soil out there, particularly on an Appalachian mining site, is less than 6 inches thick, which it often is. And in fact, the vast majority of permits that I'm aware of have been permitted under the concept of topsoil substitution that I went through, because our native topsoils tend to be thin. And so SMACRA does allow that in an Appalachian environment. Now, in the central coal basin in Illinois and in that area, because of the productivity of those soils and the prime farmland criteria, they have to take off the entire soil by the A horizon and B horizon and put it back in place. And in Western mining, it is also required.
Great. I guess there was also a sort of a follow-up question to that, just in this notion of having deep topsoil stockpiles. Is there any problem with this? Like when they're thicker than 4 feet, say, does this negatively impact any biological activity, such as?
That was a point I tried to make, although perhaps not well. The center of the pile, particularly once you're more than a meter or two from the surface, so say 4 to 5 feet, once the center of the pile goes anaerobic, which it usually will, or is limited, you're going to lose within months, large amounts of the microbial viability in the seed bank. Now, the other key there is whenever possible is deep-rooted vegetation, like we would recommend switchgrass, for example. If you can get the roots down, which you can often do 5 or 6 feet in a topsoil berm, you could probably maintain some level of viability. But there's a lot of work out there, and it seems to be, in the literature I've seen, even more important in a Western mining environment than in the East, storage thickness, if you can keep it thin enough to keep it actively rooted, then it should make it last longer. But most people who study topsoil viability and microbial populations will tell you that after 3 to 6 months of storage, large amounts of the pile lose quite a bit of their viability.
Okay.
It's still good stuff. You still need to save it and respread it. But anyone who's ever opened up one of those centers and smelled it when it comes out knows exactly what's going on in there.
Okay, so we got a question came in while you were giving your presentation. Someone wanted to know your opinion on using biosolids, and you touched on that. And I guess just related to that question, you named a number of different amendments that we can add to soils. I don't know if you want to say anything more about biosolids, but I know we're also hearing about people wanting to use a product called biochar.
But that's a very different product.
Yeah, I know.
I'll just say, in general, I'm an advocate of using organic amendments at appropriate rates, and that rate would vary. But we've used mill sludges, we've used biosolids, we've used yard waste compost, we've used wood waste compost, with generally positive results. We've used animal manures to a point, but the key there needs that they need to be stabilized. Any of these materials should be properly stabilized. And in certain environments, you've got to be concerned about nitrate loading in certain environments, particularly with heavy rates of biosolids or animal manures. There are concerns commonly expressed about nitrate leaching risk.
And do you have any experience using humates as part of remediation?
No, I've read some things about it. And I have colleagues who work with biochar. I have not. If you can get biochar in its pelletized form, so it's easy to spread, then it's my understanding it's a pretty good amendment. It tends to be very dusty and it's not easy to handle in its raw form. At least the materials the folks I work with here have dealt with.
Okay, thank you. We have someone who provided some citations that they wanted to know if you were familiar with, and they also said thank you very much for your presentation. They wanted to know if you were familiar with the calcium and sulfate concentrations of recycled concrete aggregate leachate controls for the TDS concentration, and they cite Cordray et al. 2017, saying that their work is similar to Skousen et al. 2002.
Yeah, what happens there is in the right environment, the solubility of gypsum is going to control what's in TEDS, and Skousen and Zimkevich and others have looked at that and have got algorithms set up. One of the issues we get into, and I don't want to go too far in it, is the calcium to magnesium ratio. The solubility of magnesium sulfate is really high relative to gypsum. So part of what you can do to some extent is if you can get a very high calcium ratio in it, that will limit TDS. Now, in the valley fill environments we work with, even with gypsum control, it's still going to be over 1,000 initially. And right now, the point that is of biological concern is somewhere below 500.
Okay, I think we can take one more question before we go back to your presentation. We had a questioner ask what criteria would you apply to someone who was looking at remediating phosphate mine tailings?
It's complicated. Let me say, there's tens of thousands of acres of phosphate slimes that are a dewatering, high pH nightmare. There's sandy overburden, and there's phosphogypsum. And so there's three different wastes out there, and there's a different answer for each of those. If that person would email me, I'd be happy to interact with them separately. And in fact, I've got a whole set of online lectures I'd be happy to send them on phosphate. Yeah.
Great, that sounds good. Okay, I think we're ready to move back into the second part of your presentation.
All right, so am I back on screen share there?
Yes, you are.
Okay, I just want to make sure. Let me make it work here. Okay, so what I want to wade into next in a little more detail is the underlying theory and assumptions involving asset-based accounting. And based on timing here, I may get into just a little bit about TDS at the end, but I do want to make sure we leave enough time for more follow-up questions at the end of the presentation. And my colleague, again, this work, and I openly pirated some of her slides, is Azina Orndorff, who's been a postdoc working with me now for a number of years. So I talked a little bit about these reactions earlier. So it's very important we know how much iron sulfide or other metal sulfides, they react a little differently. Even various forms of FeS2 have varying reactions, but the important thing to know is how much reduced sulfur is in the components. There's a whole series of reactions, and if you ever want to read something that's almost mind-numbing, you can look up Singer and Sturm and Nordstrom, and they'll walk you through 12 or 15 different partial reactions involved with this. But again, contrary to popular opinion, the direct oxidation step, where there's just oxygen getting in there and interacting, is relatively slow. This can, even in a highly sulfitic material, take many, many months until it finally generates just enough acidity that the pH gets down under 4.5. When the pH gets down under 4.5, there's a nasty little bug called Thiobacillus ferrooxidans and other similar species that start picking up the iron two and oxidizing it to iron three. And I know I'm going sort of backwards here. And the iron three then will directly work on pyrite. So you not only have the direct oxidation pathway, you have iron three oxidizing pyrite going to iron two, and then Thiobacillus picks it up. So what happens is we can see a mining waste creep down over months and sometimes years between pH 7, 6, 5, and then under 4.5, almost within weeks, it will be pH 3.5. We have seen certain materials, particularly certain sulfitic coastal plain sediments, be actually pH 1.8, which is the theoretical lowest pH you could possibly get in these systems. So again, the objective of acid-based accounting or these methods I'm going to talk about is to try to predict how much the total load of acidity that these various reactions are going to generate over time, and then predict how much lime or how much alkalinity you need to mix with them or have present with them in a given strata or add to them as lime. And also talk again at the end of this about certain other issues with the pyrite oxidation and its remediation. So the most popular and widely used test, even as old as it is, and actually predates this publication. Richard Smith at West Virginia was actually working on aspects of this back in the late 1960s, is called acid-base accounting. And this, it's, there are modifications, but this is still its primary text. It has two essential components and several other tests, which I won't talk about, several other simple lab tests like a Fizz test and a pH test and color involved with it. But it has two components. One is the neutralization potential, or NP. That's what is the liming ability in itself of the overburden or the sediment. And that's typically from carbonates, although we have some good evidence that over longer periods of time, even feldspars and certain other components probably are active in NP. Balanced again against that maximum potential acidity, that's what is the total acid load that's going to be generated by the sulfur over time. And that generates a parameter that is the net lime demand, which is where you take the alkalinity by NP and you subtract from that the MPA or the maximum potential acidity. And if you get a negative value, it's going to, it is net acidic. And if it's a positive value, it's going to be net alkaline, but it's not that simple. There are other methods out there that I'll talk about briefly. One of them is called PPA. This was originally invented, it's controversial, by the folks at UK. Barnheisel modified considerably by the folks at Texas A&M and others. You basically take the whole sample, hit it with 30% H2O to force all these reactions to occur. And then in a lab environment, you titrate it out. The weakness of all these materials, according to many, is they don't take time into account. And so many people would much rather do column tests, something called humidity cells, or actually take the waste and put it out in barrels and just let it leach with time. And some other methods I'll cover briefly. But in general, most commercial labs involved with mining work or broad scale water quality environmental work will do standard US EPA acid-base counting. So again, here's its history. It first came out of West Virginia University. This is just a summary of what it's been balancing out. The output is called NENP. That's the output I'll show you in the lab printouts. And again, it's the most commonly used. So NP, and again, you'll have access to these slides. I don't want to go through it in too much detail, but the bottom line is I take a soil sediment and I crush it down, okay? I then am going to add a known amount of acid to it, all right? And that known amount of acid is going to react with the neutralizer. So the blue grains here are the neutralizers. The known amount of acid is going to neutralize that, but not all the acid is going to be consumed, right? You're going to put in an excess of acid. You're going to put in an excess of acid. And then doing something called back titration, you're going to figure out how much acid didn't get consumed by the neutralizers. And then you can know how much neutralizer was there. And that's called back that step. And this gives us NP. And the reporting units are always tons of calcium carbonate per 1,000 tons of material. And that's pretty close to the 1,000 tons is approximate the estimate of 1 acre of soil or spoiler overburden 6 inches deep. Now, what you've got to be concerned about, though, is in some instances, if the material is already fully acidified and there are acid salts in it, say it's already pH 4 material, you add your acid to it, but then when you neutralize it at the end, you get a higher answer out. It actually takes more base to neutralize the acidity than you put into it. So what that tells you is you've got negative NP, meaning the material itself has its own inherent acidity that isn't due to the sulfur-based acidity. It's from the previously reacted sulfate salt. So NP can be positive or it can be negative, and I'll show you examples of that. So MPA then I've talked about already. This is the maximum potential acidity. It can be based on total sulfur or pyritic sulfur. Total sulfur tends to be more conservative because it can include organic sulfur and sulfate sulfur that aren't going to be acid forming per se, but to be conservative, many folks advocate using total sulfur. However, if you want to pay more for the analysis and the material is high enough in sulfur to support what's called sulfur fractionation, you can actually separate out what are going to be the non-reactive forms, which is organic and sulfate, from the pyritic sulfur, and then use that. But again, the important general conversion is for every 1% sulfur, if all those reactions we talked about earlier with lime or other neutralizers go to completion, 1% sulfitic sulfur is going to need 31.25 tons of calcium carbonate per 6 inches deep or 1,000 tons to completely neutralize. So then here's one example. I've got an NP in lab that says it's got 22 tons positive of calcium carbonate. Some labs will actually do an alternative method for this called calcium carbonate equivalent. That's not the purest DAS of base accounting, and it has some limitations that it tends to overestimate NP, but that would also be 2.2% CCE. In this example, the MPA, because there's 1.2% sulfur, you multiply it out. So that's going to be 37.5 tons of calcium carbonate demand. So the NNP, or the net neutralizing potential of this material in terms of lime demand, is 22 minus 37.5, or 15.5 tons of calcium carbonate. That's pretty strongly acid-forming material. A lot of our coal waste is in that neighborhood. In fact, we have a lot of coastal plain sediments in Virginia that are in that neighborhood. So what do you do with the numbers? In a classic sense, most regulations, including the Surface Mining Control Act and most mining regulations, define anything that has an NNP as minus five or lower as being toxic material. It must be isolated and or completely neutralized and or blended such that the NNP is higher than minus five. The problem with that is that a lot of people, particularly Jeff Skousen and others doing some pretty classic work in the early 2000s, showed that you could be zero, you could be up in this range of positive NNP and still in some instances have the material go acid on you and be pH less than four over time. So they and others have recommended, and I concur, that a better metric, it's called NPR, and that's the neutralization potential ratio, where you take the same numbers and ratio them out. If the ratio is less than one, okay, generally there's good evidence that that is going to be net acid forming material. If the ratio is greater than two, with very few exceptions, Skousen et al. Found that, you know, you were fairly well assured that this was going to be net alkaline material. The problem comes between one and two, that you can still have net positive NNP material, that it, most of it is going to be alkaline, but some of it can turn acidic. And I'll talk in a minute about the assumptions of why that is. So again, I talked about this already. To be conservative, we typically use total sulfur because it's conservative, but you can, if the sulfur levels are high enough and if you pay about three times as much in terms of the lab analysis, you can get it fractionated and only use sulfide. The issues with acid-base accounting, the primary one is it assumes all the sulfur is going to react and all the neutralizers are going to react at the same rate with complete and similar kinetics. And in a field setting, a lot of times that's just not true. And that's how we get net positive NMP materials, where the pyrite can actually oxidize quicker than the carbonates dissolve, or the carbonates coat up with iron oxides, and there's lots of stuff back there. The other issue is siderite, which is iron carbonate, will overestimate NP. Most labs now today use a modified Sobeck-Skousen NP method that takes that error into account. And we don't have time to talk about that, but if you're ever requesting this analysis, ask them to do the Skousen modified NP to account for siderite. There are other things that can mess up. The way we figure out how much acid we use for NP is subjective. We assume that what happens in a lab setting is going to happen in the field. We assume similar reaction rates. These are all complications with standard ABA. But that being said, it is the standard. It is the most widely used. Here's a printout out of actually our laboratory of some typical data you would see. Here's the NP values. Note that they're all positive. Here's the sulfur values. Here's the calculated MPA values. And so here's that 31.25. But in these strata through here, there's obviously much higher MPA than the neutralizers present. So I end up with very low NNPs, meaning lime demand in tons per thousand. Note that this immediately adjacent strata, only 10 feet deeper, has a huge surplus of carbonates in it. And so it's going to be a very highly net alkaline material. But here's the importance of that NP to MPA ratio. Here's another example of some data. There's the two things I want to point out here is they have them fractionated. The sulfur here, they are then using the pyritic sulfur here to be conservative, okay? But they still end up having, because these are here on the right-hand side, these are already previously acidified materials. They've got negative NPs, and they still have, particularly in these two strata, significant issues with net lime deficiency. Another method that a lot of labs use, UK offers this, I think for about $35 a sample. We can run it here again, is based on, instead of doing a separate set of analyses, you take a whole sample, flash it in H2O2, drive it down until it's stability, and put it up on a benchtop, and you titrate it. We have found this to be fairly reliable, similar to ABA, as long as you don't have a lot of carbonates in a sample, or as long as it's not a coal waste sample. But for overburden and coastal plain sediments, we find it works well. Now, kinetic test. Many people and many consultants and many very good literature indicates that kinetic test, meaning letting things leach or react over time, is a more accurate approach. It's time consuming, it's more expensive, but a lot of times you get a much better prediction of what's actually going to be in the acid mine drainage, and you can see how it changes with time. This is a column leaching technique we use here at Virginia Tech. Here's an example over leaching cycles. So these leaching cycles are actually inches of simulated rainfall over time. And so here you can see over time, the simulated rainfall we use is actually about the pH 4.5. So these are obviously very non-acid forming strongly alkaline materials with time. These are materials with moderate levels of alkalinity with them over time that overcomes the initial low pH of the rainfall. And here's a very negative acid forming of material with time. Another standard technique, there's actually an EPA and an ASTM method on this, is something called humidity cells. You basically take the reactive mining waste. This is actually a black shale from Alaska we tested. You keep it humid over time and you periodically recycle the same leachate over it and then pull a subsample out of the leachate, and that lets you see change with time and how the composition of the leachate changes with time. The folks at West Virginia for many years, and again, I keep mentioning West Virginia University because they really were the pioneers of this whole field up through the 1980s and 90s until a lot of us others had to get involved in it out of necessity. There's something called a Soxhlet reactor, which is basically a refluxing technique. I haven't seen this used in years, but it is still cited often in the literature as a standard technique. And the other approach you can take, like I said earlier, is just take material, put it out there in mesocosms or leaching barrels and pull leachates out of it over time. But this takes months or years until you see results. Now, I want to finish up quickly and very quickly show you some other issues to be concerned with, particularly in site rehab. One is acid-forming materials. This is a coastal plain sediment. Sulfate salts will eat concrete alive through a number of attacks on the cementitious binder, hydrated salts. If you put concrete, uncoated concrete, in direct contact with acid-forming material, that in itself can be a major problem. These are culverts that VDOT has been dealing with, affected by acid shales. Acid-forming materials will also direct attack most metals, particularly galvanized and ductile iron. Here's an example of a water control structure out of galvanized at one of our research sites, again, a coastal plain site, not a mining site, an airport site. This degradation occurred in less than 9 months. VDOT has problems with guardrails. This is another coastal plain site near Richmond. There are highly expansive minerals that form from the direct contact of sulfate in the interior of the concrete in a high pH environment that are tremendously expansive and shatter the concrete and then open it up in terms of more weathering attack. It's been a problem in Canada. VDOT has had problems with roads buckling for it. So the point of all that is there's other problems other than acid mine drainage associated with identifying sulfides. Finally, let me finish up with this. There are going to be some other slides posted, both a little bit on remediating acid sulfates and on TDS that I will not have time to get to. What do you do with these materials? Avoid it whenever possible. Test ahead of time. Don't leave it exposed. Add a lime coating to it if it is going to be exposed so you can keep that fast reaction from occurring. Ensure that the fill is not going to get oxygenated to the groundwater. Even if it's deep in a mining fill, if oxygenating groundwater is going to get to it, or in some instances, even relatively low oxygen groundwater, simply placing it under a vegetated cap will not avoid long-term acid discharge. So within that, like I said, there are a few more slides posted on some acid material remediation examples and a section on TDS that there's considerable material posted to our research website, along with citations on that anyone particularly who is interested in those materials, if they will email me sometime following this talk, then I'll be happy to send them those materials and any of the citations and journal articles on those material, particularly on the acid forming materials or the TDS prediction methods that I didn't get to here today. All right, so with that, I'll slow down and stop, and we have about 9 minutes or so left. And then I will see if I can answer a few more questions.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I just want to remind the participants that you can continue to submit your questions and answer questions in the question and answer window, and I will read them aloud to Dr. Daniels as they come in. But I guess an overarching question that came up, folks are wondering, and I guess maybe this is like in an ideal world, when should, you know, a site that's going to be doing mining start considering the reclamation process?
Well, by permit, they've got to, in every federal program I'm aware of, in every state program, to get the permit issued, you have to have a reclamation plan. And to get the reclamation plan in almost all instances, you have to at least do acid-based accounting or have a certified geologist sign off on a statement that says in this environment, you will not find sulfides. And in most permit packages, there needs to be some sort of a topsoil salvage, respreading, and or soil reconstruction protocol coupled with a revegetation plan. At least in the states I've worked in, which is about 10, under modern permitting regulations, those are all required. Now, if it's an open pit hard rock mine, then you still have to deal with the overburden and anything offsite, but there's a whole other set of things done with fencing and safety and high wall reduction and stuff in that mining as well.
Great. I know that the primary focus of your presentation today was to talk about the soil reclamation, but we were also talking about vegetation to a certain extent. And you had mentioned problems with some of the invasive species like autumn olive. Do you have any experiences you can share on how to eradicate such invasive species like that?
No, it's not my specialty, but autumn olive in the coal fields is almost eating us alive in certain instances. It's so invasive. The only viable ways I know to kill it is to cut it and then herbicide the stumps. Now, if you can get the competition above it, particularly trees, it I don't think it'll come in under shade. But we still have tremendous issues with Sericea lespinosa and other species like that are highly competitive against native species.
Yeah, that's definitely true about the autumn olive. It does not grow in the deeply shaded areas. And I'm just speaking from experience because I purchased a home in West Virginia and it is all along the edge. And I have been cutting it down to the stump and considering the herbicide use. But
we cut it and paint stumps where we need to get it out of, like the research plots. We did have a person who work with goats. And they were pretty effective at chewing it down and suppressing it. But then we had a pack of coyotes come in and kill the goats.
Yeah, nature. So I'm not seeing any more questions coming in. I will let you know that we did receive one question if you did consulting, and Gene reached out to that person and provided them with your contact information. Just letting you know.
Yeah, I do a little that I do a little when I can.
Yeah. We know you're a very busy man, and we're glad to have your time today. So like I said, I don't see any more questions coming in. I want to thank you very much for your presentation today. It was very well received, and Jean will give us a recap on everything. Is there any last remarks that you would like to make?
No, I'm fine. We had today a tremendous turnout here. I know by looking at some of the names, I recognized few of our attendees were very advanced and know as much as I do about, for example, asset-based accounting and things like that. So, but my intention here was to really focus on these soil reconstruction issues and then how to combine that in terms of assessment, the criteria. And yeah, I intentionally stayed away from spending a whole lot of time on revegetation. So, yeah.
Well, that can be a topic for another webinar. Maybe I can talk to you about maybe some potential speakers. But thank you so much for your time today.
Okay.
I'm going to turn it back over to Jean.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. So I'm going to go ahead and swap out the view here and put up our closing reminder slides and echo those thanks to our live audience. We also want to thank everyone who joined us in today's live broadcast. We had approximately 115 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. So we hope that you all found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll stay connected with us and visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, so that you can receive emails as soon as webinars like today's session are made available for registration. Now, one other quick reminder that I wanted to point everybody to, and bear with me, my slides are slowly responding. A number of you have asked for copies of the presentation material. We have posted those slides already on the seminar homepage. So this is the same page that you visited when checking in today. And this page is available from today forward. So if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's session, you can still visit this URL to download the slides, open up related websites, as well as access the online feedback form. So remember, that's at cluin.org/conf/TIO/mining-humid-region. So you'll find a whole collection of resources on our session on that website. I'm often asked if we offer CEUs or PDHs, and while we do not offer those types of professional credit hours, we can provide you with the seminar participation certificate. Oftentimes, attendees are able to take their registration email, copies of the slides, and then the certificate of participation to document their attendance for their own accrediting institution. So for those of you looking for a participation certificate, please fill out the online feedback form. Remember, that's linked on that seminar homepage that I just highlighted, and be sure to check the box at the bottom of that form certifying you were here for the whole thing or replayed the whole recording. If you don't check that box, you won't get a certificate. So if you check the box and put in your email address, you'll then immediately have access to one of these certificates that you can save or print out for your own records. And if you happen to have a number of people joining at your particular location, each person can fill out that form on their own to get their own certificate, even if they didn't register on that on their own. And that goes for those of you who replayed this recording all the way to the very end. If you made it here, you can still go to that seminar homepage and fill out that feedback form to get your own certificate of participating based on your replay of the archive. So with that, I want to thank again, everybody who joined us, as well as Dr. Daniels and Michelle for sharing their time and expertise today. We look forward to hearing your feedback on our session and our movement over to this new platform. And with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.